Today's program was brought to you by Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
This week on Meat & Three, we're bringing you four stories about lost and found culinary treasures.
We are searching for what will be lost, and we're trying to rejuvenate it.
What we try to do is collect these sourdoughs that contribute to the biodiversity of sourdough in order to store them, to document them, and be able to preserve them for the future.
It's bringing back the history and just being part of that time that just... there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it.
When fame comes late, I'm sure it's just as sweet as when it comes earlier.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat & Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coralie. Joining me today from LA by phone is Sarita C., author of The Decolonized Eye and the Filipino Primitive, media and cultural studies professor at UC Riverside, and founder and curator of online exhibition space Center for Art and Thought. Welcome to the show, Sarita.
Thank you, Coral. How are you doing?
Good, good. I was listening to the commercial, and I think it's so funny that I feel like it's very topical, like the collection of diverse sourdough breads. And so we'll kind of talk about the importance of curating a collection of history.
That sounded amazing. It really reminds me also of some material history scholars that I've started to learn about, in particular those who focus on Asian American material history, including food and cooking utensils.
Mm-hmm. So actually, let's just get right into it. Why is Asian, Oceania, et cetera, always grouped together in the museum space, and why is that still happening?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Out of curiosity.
That's a really important question, and I can just, offer one of, I think, a million different ways to answer that question. Since you're located in New York City, right?
Mm-hmm.
New York City. One way to answer that question has to do with the Museum of Natural History, right off of Central Park, where families, parents with their kids tend to go, and it's usually one of the earliest exposures, if children go to museums, to the division of the world into really simplistic binaristic categories. Like, what is considered a civilization that has culture, and what or who is considered primitive or savage? And from there, one really easily and unconsciously picks up the message, the basic story, which is that there is a story of development, that certain peoples and civilizations are barbaric, primitive, belong to a particular zone of the planet, and other civilizations are capable of thinking, are capable of being rational, and are civilized, and hence kind of represent universal man. And so part of the collapse of Asia and Oceania is part of that larger categorization and division of the planet, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so what is Center for Art and Thought, and how are you fighting this institution with the online exhibition space?
So the Center for Art and Thought, this is a primarily web-based organization that the filmmaker and educator Angel Velasco Shaw and I co-founded now about five and a half years ago, And so a couple things that we were trying to do. First of all, you know, that idea of the universal, right? Who gets to be the universal representation of man, right? Which hides that story of who gets to be civilized, who gets to be rational, right? The first thing we wanted to do was to challenge that idea that that Filipino culture and Filipino diasporic culture in particular could actually be the center, the point of departure for thinking about all kinds of things, for thinking about arts, education, scholarship, all of that. And so Center for Art and Thought was about recentering how we think about the center, right? Mm-hmm. But also trying to bring together to, in curating and editing online group exhibitions, to bring together arts and scholarship in the same space and to hopefully produce a kind of intersection and new conversations between arts and scholars who don't typically talk very well with each other for lots of different reasons. So that's kind of in short, shorthand, the center came about.
Yeah. What exactly is it about Filipino history / diasporic culture that makes it such rich fodder to become this point of departure?
Right. So, I start by saying that I knew nothing about the relationship, the history of the relationship between the Philippines and the United States until college, when I first learned about the Philippine-American War, which it broke out in 1899. So this is, now 100 and almost 120 years ago now. Broke out in 1899, lasted until 1913. And according to our more recent, scholars, was a genocidal war of military conquest. Totally devastating, monumentally devastating war. And I was horrified in college, that would be, when I was like 19, 20 years old, that would be the first time I ever really heard about this. So I started to kind of think about this along with lots of different other, people who would go on to, do scholarship about this, both in and outside of the university, about what this meant. And if you take a look at things like the 1904 World's Fair, right? So, and the way in which the Philippines and what would become Filipino peoples, how they were exhibited at the fair alongside all other kinds of peoples and civilizations who were just put on display, right? A number of us started to realize is that the visual display of the Philippines and so-called Filipino peoples was happening at the same time that this military conquest of the Philippines by America was going on. So what's really kind of distinct, I think, about the Philippines and Filipino diaspora is that the relationship between empire and vision, like how we see, is so tightly intertwined. And from there, right, I started to try to track through the Center for Art and Thought, but also through my written publications, how this redounds, how this continues to echo in really powerful ways in Filipino diasporic, in particular U.S. Filipino diasporic culture today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's actually go back to the 1904 World Fair. When I saw a slide of that in art history in college, it just blew me away, and I wish I could have gone. Can you talk a bit about what was exhibited and why it was exhibited and who it was for, and also what was problematic about the way things were exhibited?
Before I answer, can you tell me a little bit about what was your college class about and what was that slide doing there?
Mm-hmm. So it was a visiting professor. She was supposed to teach Baroque art, but she went totally rogue and did what she called the global early modern. And so it was just a class in colonial art, which was actually the inspiration for this podcast. I noticed similar things happening in food and just seeing pictures of this World Fair and also the illustration of the Wunderkammer. Those have just followed me, and I've thought about them a lot these past few years. And yeah, so thank you, Jenny Sakai, wherever you are.
What was the name again?
The professor is Jenny Sakai. I believe she teaches at Reed now. Yes.
Oh, fantastic. there was a lot of food at the World's Fair, right? I mean, ice cream in particular is a huge hit, I think. So this 1904 World's Fair was at St. Louis and had this giant, both in terms of the number of people who were imported from the Philippines, as well as the acreage that the Philippine exhibit, as it was called, I think, took up in the World's Fair, and the fair, I think it lasted. It was open to the public. I can't remember how many months it was open for, but it did attract a lot of people, and the Philippine exhibit, because of the size of it, and also because the Philippines through the war, right, was on, I mean, in headlines, right, and on people's minds, right, really attracted a lot of attention. So it was really kind of the way in which Americans at the turn of the century, right, over, 116 years ago or so, first kind of really understood what it meant to be a transoceanic global power in the wake of, sort of its establishment as a settler, transcontinental power coming out of the wars against indigenous peoples in the Americas. So the World's Fair, was really, really crucial for Americans, I think, to grasp, understand, and learn about how to become a visual imperial power in a very, very ordinary and kind of leisure and entertainment kind of way.
It's really interesting that it's the target audience is Americans, and it's not to better understand others' cultures or practices or even food, but just how to, as you say, embody this transoceanic power. And so what are some ways that they conveyed this power, or how to flex these powers?
I'm sorry, what are some ways? Can you talk a little bit about that?
The reason why I'm always bringing, mm-hmm. or I always want to talk about art history on the show is I see so much of this mm-hmm. happening in food, where people will go to quote unquote ethnic restaurants and say, I had duck foot and it was wild, but I overcame it. And there's that weird subject-object relationship with food. And I think that happens also in this World Fair. And so in what ways do people or maybe attendants consume this fair? And what does it tell them about their perceived power?
Gotcha. There are a whole bunch of books and articles about this particular fair and World Fairs in general. But part of what happened is, as I understand it, is that as you went through the fair and then also within the Philippine exhibit, everything is sort of, there's a whole design, right? It's the architecture to the fair, to any kind of exhibit, right? To any museum space, gallery space, right? Park, right? But the thing is, as you toured, went through the fair, your footpath, right? How you actually walk through the fair and look at things is being mapped in a way that's telling a story, right? About which Filipino, so-called Filipino groups of people are civilized, right? Or closer to being civilized, who wear, for example, Western clothing, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to those people who are being displayed and are actually, this is all very sort of, choreographed, right? who are being asked or, you know, trained, you know, by the fair organizers to display themselves in semi-naked, you know, conditions and to, you know, consume certain things that are utterly taboo, for example, dog, right? And the term dog eater, you know, is you know, the closest one thing can come to saying that somebody is taboo other than being a cannibal, right? So to eat, you know, your best friend, the dog, right? So that's part of what is being displayed, right? You're kind of, you know, eating something amazing like ice cream, a sweet, you know, kind of treat that an everyday, you know, American kind of consume, all the way to learning, right, about the hierarchy of peoples and cultures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then to build on that, what exactly is the quote-unquote Filipino primitive, and how to transcend this moniker?
Right. So, you know, I was like, why is this so hard to to explain? Right, so I used to teach at the University of Michigan in the Midwest. And Coraline, have you ever been to the Midwest?
Oh, I went to school for 2 years in middle of nowhere, Ohio. So yes.
Yes. So you know.
I understand.
Okay.
Yeah, people were asking me what Korean, Japanese, everything was. And like, I would answer because I knew, but it was also like, wait, I'm not any of those. Why am I like your Wikipedia for this now? Yeah. Anyway, I understand.
Okay. Yes. So the Midwest, right, typically, you know, people associate the Midwest with America's heartland, right, and that, you know, hard to find, you know, anything other than sort of generic, so-called generic white food or whatever. The thing is with the Midwest, Midwestern universities, like the University of Michigan, and also Wisconsin in particular, and universities in Illinois, got tapped for becoming experts in the Philippines. There's a whole long story about this, but there are a bunch of like anthropologists, or including amateur anthropologists and ethnologists and botanists, who started going to the Philippines along with some students to start collecting butterflies, ferns, but then also some human artifacts, right? And start building this collection for the founding of natural history and anthropological museums.
This is recently.
This is from the 1880s on. Yeah. So there's a huge collection on the Philippines in the Midwest, as weird as that sounds. And so while I was working at the University of Michigan, I, you know, because I work on Filipino diasporic stuff and started to get to know about Southeast Asian studies and Philippine studies, started to get to know something about the history of this collection, and I just, you know, it was this collection as well as an exhibition, which did, you know, just confirmed this idea of the primitive Filipino. So, you know, how do we beat that? How do we, you know, sort of try to challenge that moniker, as you asked? Part of what I realized is that it's actually not enough. It's important, but it's not adequate or enough to challenge these ideas as either true or false, or authentic versus inauthentic, because it doesn't really get at what I thought was the heart of the matter, which had to do with this accumulation of of artifacts and things, and including, in one case that I saw, human teeth. Human teeth from the Philippines.
Hmm.
Because they were, you know, as well as artifacts from burial grounds, like sacred burial grounds, that these Michigander anthropologists collected, you know. This is violating every, you know, ethical kind of, you know, principle, and then bringing it back to the Midwest. So part of what I realized is that this whole founding and even idea of academic expertise and knowledge was really founded on who's considered, once again, primitive, and who's considered not only civilized, but universal.
Mm-hmm.
Hence, this concept of the Filipino primitive in relationship to this concept of primitive accumulation, which is more, you know, connected to Marxist economic concepts of the foundations of capitalism.
Yeah, I want to get back to the Marxist idea, but I wanted to also tie this back to our opening question, which is you talked a bit about how our understanding, or quote unquote, our understanding of Philippine history is through the Museum of National History of Art, Natural History of Art. And so why is it that these artifacts rarely transcend to or become displayed in art museums? Why are they relegated to science or history museums?
Yes, that really cuts to, I think, the heart of the matter. Why is it that, you know, there's this division, right, between art and nature, right? And some people get to have the ability, right, to create art, and other people are incapable of creating art. And what they create is sort of closer to nature. So, for example, New York City, back in New York City, and here I'm going to just completely plagiarize from the scholar Mika Ball. Mika Ball has this really wonderful analysis of Central Park in New York City, right? So Central Park, right, is divided in lots of different ways, but it's definitely divided between the West Manhattan versus East Manhattan, right? So you got the Upper West Side and the Upper East Side. So Museum of Natural History is on the west side of the park. Coral, what are the museums on the east side of the park that first come to leap to your mind?
My geography is so bad, but I'm thinking like the Museum of Modern Art.
Yes, the Met. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just think about the difference between the Met, right? That's like high art, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and that is European. I mean, there's all kinds of art, you know, kind of, but in terms of like what people go there for, it's the experience typically of high art, right? European art. And you bring your kids, right, to see the dinosaurs and then exotic peoples over on the other side of the park, right? So that's how that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Why certain civilizations, certain kinds of arts do appear in a natural history museum, and why they do not appear in the Whitney, right? For example.
Yeah, so let's...
Well, that's changing.
Let's get back to primitive accumulation. Could you break that down for us and identify some more tangible examples of that happening with in the art space or the history space?
So Karl Marx is, you know, known for this concept called primitive accumulation, and it's basically about the kind of clearing of so-called empty land, which means the emptying of lands of the genocidal emptying of lands of indigenous peoples, and the extrication of labor in order to work the land, in order to eventually become a capitalist economy, right? So you have to accumulate capital, labor, land, right? In the beginning, so-called primitive stages of capitalism, right? So while reading this, I, once again, you know, just because it's where I worked in the Midwest, right, I wondered whether or not that concept of primitive accumulation would actually apply to the accumulation of so many things, right? Including the thingification, I guess we could call it the objectification of peoples like Filipinos in the university archives, and then in the university exhibition. So those are the kind of ideas I was thinking about. So whereas primitive accumulation typically is kind of used in a way to describe economic forces and phenomena like capitalism, I saw similar kinds of forces and phenomena happening in the accumulation of things to produce knowledge, academic knowledge in the university, right? So those are the two kind of parallel processes. In terms of some tangible examples of both what this actually looks like in the archive and in museum space, and as well, also some contemporary Filipino American artists who have really kind of pushed back against this. So I actually was just at the Met in New York City, and as you walk up, you know, you enter kind of, there's two staircases, right? That there's that huge external staircase as you walk up to the Met, and you're already starting to feel like you're entering some kind of cathedral, right? You're like, okay, this is, everything is getting very grand, right? And I'm feeling very, very small and in awe, right? And being prepared to be in awe of things. And then you enter the building and you go up the second, you know, staircase, which is internal to the building, and you start to see this whole line of what looks to be classical Asian, like Chinese and Japanese, perhaps Korean, right, vases displayed. And, you know, I think what the museum, what the meta message is being conveyed to the everyday museum goer is just power through accumulation, right? Like, we have an enormous archive, right? A collection. And it's just through the sheer numbers, right? The sheer amount of capital, right? That is impressive, right? It's also like the aura, right? The aura that tends to impress us, right? There's, look at this age, this patina of age, right? Of these precious things. So then this cuts to somebody like Stephanie Sujuko, who is an artist in the San Francisco Bay Area, and she's a Filipina immigrant. She migrated from the Philippines to California when she was a kid. And she eventually grew up to become an artist. And she's got this really great multimedia, you know, I guess you could sculpture, where she just downloaded a bunch of images of classical Asian ceramics vases. She just printed them out and then slapped them on woodcuts. And then got a bunch of packing crates and then just propped them up. All these fake vases, right? and then you step away, right? Like I think she says something like, you know, she just wanted to make it look good from 14 feet away, you know? And so it kind of just, it's a really, really funny, but I think actually very serious parody, mm-hmm. and a very subversive parody of that accumulative tendency of the museum.
Mm-hmm. This is a perfect place to take a break. When we get back, we'll talk a bit more about transcending the moniker Filipino primitive and what it means to quote unquote decolonize the eye.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. Patina is also the exclusive caterer at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium, to galas in the renovated Palm House, and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe overlooking Lilypool Terrace. Executive chef Morgan Jarrett's unique menu offers warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Lisa Held, and I'm the host of The Farm Report here on HRN. The Farm Report is a show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Expect from-the-field insights as guests explore how producing fresh, delicious food relates to environmental and community sustainability, justice, and better health. You can find The Farm Report wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. So we were talking about the idea of the Filipino primitive, and you were saying how it's not so simple as just challenging the name or refusing to use it, and that it's not so black and white. And so a pretty buzzy phrase is decolonize the blank. And what does it mean to decolonize the eye, and how is this one avenue by which we can subvert the title, the Filipino primitive?
Decolonize the eye. Gosh, so many.
I know, so many questions. Like, it's like a five paragraph hamburger essay.
Brain freeze. So I feel like what I've been trying to do over the past, you know, I don't know, gosh, maybe 15 years or so, is to pay attention to what our cultural producers, what Filipino American, in particular, Filipino American cultural producers are trying to do. And I do think that some of the most exciting work, and you have to pay close attention though sometimes, right, have to do with representational strategies that are decolonial. So for example, the work of Rianne Estrada, who is a Filipino American, I think originally from the East Coast and now based in California for quite a while now. I've been kind of paying, a number of us have been paying attention to her solo artist, her work as a solo artist. She does all kinds of stuff. And the scholar Neferchi Tadiar, who teaches at Barnard and a couple of other people, were really drawn to the way in which she uses everyday things, especially things that can deteriorate in her sculpture, like bars of soap, bars of ivory soap and or erasers or scotch tape, right? And she creates all these really, really kind of very, very detailed, labor-intensive sculptures. They're really beautiful to look at and kind of abstract, right? Like, and I was really drawn to one series, her soap series, where she took bars of ivory soap. And of course, already, because she's chosen ivory soap, you already know something is up because the brand ivory soap is really really indexes the history of racialized and imperial hygiene, which soap brands, older soap brands in particular, their advertising marketing really, really kind of incredibly racist and imperial, right? Like, you need to clean yourself.
Well, yeah, I didn't know anything about this. Can you give an example of an ad or some copy they used?
Oh gosh, yeah. I don't have actually a logo with me right now. But there's this really great collection called The Forbidden Book, which has a collection of photographs and ads which display Uncle Sam, America's Uncle Sam, right, cleaning, you know, in a river. It's new colonies, that is to say Guam, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, who are portrayed as pickaninny, basically.
Yes.
Right? To try to, you know, clean the dirt, so-called dirt, off of their newly, it's newly, America's newly acquired colonies. So anyways, soap, right? So Rhiannon Estrada takes bars of soap, in particular ivory soap, and then lines these bars of soap with her own hair, strands of her own hair, which is actually very curly hair, and she strains them out, though. And she uses a lot of her hair in order to create these really beautiful, you know, kind of black and white, like black lines on white background sculpture that kind of looks like Frank Stella's, kind of the inverse of Frank Stella's paintings, his black paintings, right? Which are sort of canonical for, you know, works now in terms of the rise of particular forms of American minimalism. Huh. So the way she displays them in the gallery is hilarious too. She just puts these hairline bars of soap, right, on a black felt, right, on a pedestal, and then covers it with this glass kind of diorama looking thing, so it sort of looks like something really precious. Sort of feels, though, a little bit like the Natural History Museum again, something behind glass, but it looks like modern art. At the same time, though, it is the Filipino body on display. It's her hair, after all, right? So it's literally, you know, her body on display, but it doesn't look like it at all. Anyways, I know this all sounds kind of really, you know, I don't know, kind of convoluted, but that, I think, if we slow down and take a look at what, you know, what our cultural producers are doing, if we take a second look and maybe a third look or a fourth look, we can see these decolonizing principles and you know, works that they are developing. So that's one way I think we can sort of decolonize the eye. The other way that's kind of related to a new project that I'm developing right now. I'm trying to develop maybe an essay, maybe kind of a handbook something along the lines of a visual culture or visual culture method book. I mean, Cora, when you were an art history major, right?
Mm-hmm.
What were kind of like the sources, books, doesn't have to be a book, you know, handbooks, anything that were kind of inspiring for you to develop your own eye that you recall, or maybe not? I mean, maybe, was there anything out there that really helped, you know, that you thought were actually helpful for Asian diasporic, Asian American?
Not specifically art. Asian diasporic art. Unfortunately, as you might imagine, it was limited to like 30 minutes of one day, the last day of the semester.
Yeah.
It was so short. But I thought, especially in this class, looking at a lot of the more historical texts regarding chinoiserie was very telling. And it didn't quite get at that level of criticism that I think we're getting at right now, but it is useful still to, you know, consider it from that colonial historical eye.
Yeah. So what I'd like to write, you know, or, you know, kind of develop is, you know, what would your, you know, kind of art or visual culture method book look like, you know? what would you have liked to have had, to have been able to read,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
10 years ago or so, right? So anyways, I'm trying to kind of develop that. And part of what I'm realizing is that it's really easy to still kind of fall into this high art versus low art trap.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
And so what I'm trying to kind of, and this will get to the food, and you'll see how fully self-serving this is. But, you know, when you go to Filipino-American restaurants or eateries, a lot of them, the ones that are not high-end, right, that's a fairly new phenomenon, this kind of huge trend, which is fascinating to me, of Filipino-American chefs and restaurants. But if you go to your basic turo-turo restaurant, do you know what turo-turo means?
No, can you explain?
Yeah, it's turo-turo means to point, like point. So it's like a buffet style, like cafeteria style, very, very low-key restaurant, very casual. So it's all buffet style, and you walk up to the buffet and then you point at, like, say, the, you know, one or two main entries that you want to eat with your side of rice. So mm-hmm. for example, you know, I would like some, you know, chicken adobo and a side of, you know, mixed vegetables, sauteed vegetables with my side of rice. That's a point turo-turo restaurant. Have you been to any of the turo-turo restaurants in New York or anywhere else?
I have not.
Do you
have any recs? Yeah.
Oh. You know, well, you know, Manhattan has gotten really gentrified. So anyway, wherever there's a hospital, you know, along First Avenue with all those hospitals, mm-hmm. right? There's going to be a bunch of Filipino workers in the hospital, right?
All right, doctors, just find the nearest hospital.
Yeah, exactly. Find a hospital, and you'll probably find a turo-turo restaurant not that far away catering to Filipino workers.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, when you go into a turo-turo restaurant, there's a look and design and smell, right, to a turo-turo restaurant that's pretty distinct. There's typically a TV blasting some kind of soap opera or talk show or, you know, an action movie, full blast. There's certain kinds of art, you know, up on the walls, like a giant fork or fork and spoon or the Last Supper, right? and I'm kind of just, what I've been wondering is, like, what if we think about that as visual culture,
mm-hmm.
you know, as art that the community itself is producing. And part of what the feel experience of a turo-turo restaurant really reminds one of is an immigrant living room, right? It's mm-hmm. like, it feels like home, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of the turo-turo restaurants, as well as bakeries, Filipino bakeries that I know, people just hang out there, like, for hours. hours. And it's much more than a commercial space. It is actually a semi-communal gathering space. Sometimes it can be actually a refuge where people can gather to find out about a visa, how to you know, provide services, actually, on a very, very informal basis. Anyway, so so that's one idea I'm kind of kicking around right now is, I think I need to do some research on Duotoro restaurants and visit many of them.
Yeah, hard work.
Hard
work that you'll just have to do. So for our last, 2 minutes, I have one huge question to ask. But for, and this is in regards to your visual cultural methods prescribing for viewing Asian diasporic art. So how would you advise the critical viewing of Asian artists / food producing in response to or despite their own Asian experience?
Despite their own, I'm sorry, what was the...
Right, so I feel like with looking at Asian diasporic art or even Asian chefs, it's like, oh, they have to cook Asian food or they have to make Asian art. How do you critically engage with their art without pigeonholing?
Right, yeah, no, that's a really, really great question. I mean, one of the ways in which And I think it's proven to have limits, right? One of the ways to kind of respond to that or challenge that has to do with the invocation of freedom of expression, right? Mm-hmm. And that's important, but the thing is, like, you very quickly get into a trap because it's like, who gets to be free? You know, like, it doesn't, you know, only certain people tend to, you know, get to be free at the cost of other people's freedom, right? So... That's kind of a trap. I don't know. I mean, how can I ask you how you might kind of go about that question, Coral?
I have no clue. I think it's just...
Oh, my God.
it's a hard one. I think... Yeah, I don't know. And I think...
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go for it.
One way might be to rethink how we actually think about the work of art. And so we tend to think, and this is really drawing on my partner, David Lloyd's new book on race called Underrepresentation. But part of what he's arguing, and I agree with him, is that the work of art typically is associated with freedom, right? Freedom from politics, right? And there's another way, though, is to kind of think about the work of art as something that bears the scars, right? Bears the trauma of struggle. And so that's one way to kind of think about the relationship between art and freedom and politics, that's not about pigeonholing, but actually, you know, opening up the idea of history in relationship to our artists and our cultural producers and what they're trying to do, rather than just reducing them to their biology or something, which is totally racist. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so maybe that's one way to kind of start to think about, rethink, critically rethink what our culture producers are doing.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to end our episode. Proof that the conversation is not black nor white, but just another shade of gray. So thank you so much for joining me today, Sarita.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.